Hi everyone, I'm Gary Noll. Always nice to share this empowering hour with you. Today, from the University of Dhaka, which is in Bangladesh, the role of ashwagandha, a compound in the management of Alzheimer's disease. Very important study, and that will help the millions upon millions of Americans and people worldwide, because we're heard worldwide, in helping with this scourge. Also today, from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, calcium, when you have enough, precisely directs your blood flow into the brain. What's that about? I'll explain. Then we'll take a look at how 1 in 20 cases of dementia occurs in younger people. Yeah, people under 65. Mayo Clinic says that. How's that happening? What can we do? What can we do at any age to prevent dementia? Remember, it starts early. What about Washington University School of Medicine study about the good cholesterol can protect your liver? I'll explain the difference between good cholesterol and bad cholesterol and why that's important so that we can have a healthy cholesterol all the time. And then from Loyola University in Chicago, vitamin D supplementation may be a low-cost supportive care therapy for women with metastatic breast cancer. Wow. And I just counseled someone 5 o'clock this morning on what to do about metastatic breast cancer after an advanced stage near death, and that there are options. And how about the University of Illinois with lutein can counter cognitive aging? Everyone should be aware of that and benefit from that. I'll explain that in the details because it's all in the details. And how about from Colorado State University, where aerobic exercise boosts healthy brain aging? It's all about aging now, if you're paying attention. But unfortunately, the mainstream media would like us to believe that, well, aging is a disease. And the more you age chronologically, the more disease you're susceptible to. And that's not true at all. And I will challenge those who believe that, well, it's kind of inevitable. You're a certain age, you have to act your age. That's not true either. Almost everything we've heard about the aging process is wrong. Not intentionally, just they haven't looked where the answers are. They keep looking at the same paradigm and wondering why there's not a better outcome. So we're going to look at a different paradigm. And I'm finishing up a major book on aging right now and a very important article on aging. I'm submitting the article for peer review publication, and then I'll present it on the air, and then I'll post it. And this is something that can help everyone in this audience. Brand new information. And that's why I'm hopeful that it will get some people kickstarting their healthier habits. Also today, a commentary from someone that we have a great deal of respect for. That's Chris Hedges from SharePost, a collective suicide machine. That's his. But also today, and I'll be adding my own commentary on that, plus a brand new, in-depth investigative report on GMOs, and a response to the New York Times heavy promotion on their cover, their Sunday magazine section, on pro-GMOs. Well, we're going to deconstruct their arguments, and we're going to show you that their idea of learning to love GMOs, that's the title of their article, ours is learning to loathe GMOs, a critical response to the New York Times. We will be sending this today to the New York Times editorial board, all of their editorial board, and challenging them on a lack of objectivity, and also to the author, professor, highly regarded and highly respected professor, and I will give her the complete benefit of a doubt. As a result, there'll be no attacking her, but rather deconstructing her arguments, and then hopefully that will open it up to a larger debate. And I've invited her to come on this program, as I have D'Angelo to come on this program to debate me on her thesis. And we're hopeful that someone on that level will take us up so the audience can hear multiple sides and decide if any of it makes sense to them. Also today, I'm going to play what I consider an extraordinarily important clip from a person who knows what he's talking about. He is Professor Sukarit Bhakadi, B-H-A-K-D-I, He's a medical doctor with over 50 years in science and medicine, professor, very prestigious institution, and he has a background in immunology, pathology, and so he's going to tell us, and you can accept or reject it, that we already have antibody memory of COVID-19, rendering 99% of us immune. And this is not only makes vaccination unnecessary, in his opinion, but revaccination potentially threatens our life. And we're seeing more and more studies on that coming out. But why aren't we hearing about this anywhere else in the news? Why is it just vaccinate, mandate the vaccines? If you don't vaccinate, you're a danger to society. You're irresponsible. You're stupid. When we're finding just the opposite is true, and in fact, MIT has shown that those who are not vaccinating because they're anti-vaccine. To the contrary, they're pro-vaccine, but they're looking at the side effects of the first type of genetically engineered vaccine, this RNA vaccine of its kind, and they don't want to jump in there and then end up with side effects. Because when you have tens of thousands of dead people around the world from the vaccine and millions upon millions injured, many permanently from the vaccine, and now we're finding out that people who are vaccinated are shedding the vaccine, and we're finding out that people who have been vaccinated are coming down at a higher percentage with COVID again, and that the antibody protection only lasts about 2 to 3 months, that means they're lining us up to have everyone have multiple vaccines. It's a whole industry with hundreds of companies involved, and no one is saying, hold on a second, shouldn't we at least be cautious, engage the precautionary principle of let us make sure that this is safe before we inoculate a whole world? And why aren't you talking about lifestyle changes to prevent this? Why aren't we talking about building up people's immune system? Why aren't we not talking about the most vulnerable people, those with comorbidities, of working with them to help them overcome their comorbidities? None of that. Why aren't we talking about repurposing old FDA-approved drugs that are shown to be non-toxic and very effective, far more so than any vaccine? But we're not. So that should tell you that there's another agenda afoot. And Dr. Bacardi is going to give you a demonstration. I suggest you go to prn.fm, scroll down to where it says Gary's notes, and you can watch him because he has a blackboard. It's a little technical. I'm not going to play the whole clip, but I'll explain what he is saying. And also, for those of you who sent me, and a lot of people sent it to me, a highly regarded medical doctor in Italy was supposed to do an ad for pro-vaccine. And boy, did she let it rip. Because most people in this audience don't speak Italian, I'll read what she has to say, just part of her, for about a minute, because she goes after the vaccine. I mean, no holes barred. So that didn't work out so well over there. But now we have probably 100,000 more or less physicians and scientists who are challenging Anthony Fauci, the World Health Organization, and yet none of them are given any credibility. Even the Nobel Prize winners, even the people who've had impeccable credentials, orthodox against orthodox. But these are people in the front trenches actually treating people. They're the ones I trust, not the bureaucrats in Washington or the World Health Organization or Anthony Fauci. So all this we're going to share today. Just a quick reminder and just a little bit of an explanation. I've been on this sister station, WBI, for 45 years. And there have been periods of time in that 45 years that I've seen some very important positive changes. And then there was the effort to sequester a political identity for the station and remove all of the progressive minds. And they did, and they succeeded. Not just here, but across the whole network. And boy, could this foundation learn some lessons from how really successful nonprofit radio stations and nonprofit foundations work. And it's not about different groups fighting each other nonstop, which is always the case with Pacifica, and no one having any qualifications in nonprofit radio or nonprofit foundations or fundraising, but thinking they know everything. There's nothing more unique than people who are so self-righteous and so arrogant, so conceited, that their ideology is all that's important. And that's permanent throughout the whole system. As a result, today, we are a zombie network, last in every market. I wish it weren't so. The only people who are not getting the attention they deserve, unfortunately, are the audience. You see, when you call in and you make a pledge, you have every right to expect that in a timely way. Unfortunately, that's not happening, so I can't do any more pledging. And as part of the responsibility of not doing any more pledging, I can't stay in a station that says if you don't pledge, you can't stay. And that's fine. I respect that. I would love to see all of our older hosts, myself included, gracefully move away to allow young, vital voices that represent all the boroughs and the neighborhoods where it's really community radio. I think that's what would really save and hopefully re-energize the station. It shouldn't be used to attack other people. Nobody wants to hear that. And those who do want to hear that, well, that's part of the problem of the station. People want to be empowered in a positive way, not listen to denigration and personal and ad hominem attacks. That doesn't work. If you want to see why it doesn't work, just look at all the stations. Every station in Pacifica is just, unfortunately, their own life support. And it is not going to get better until they completely change how they're managing. I won't go into how I believe that they could remanage, repurpose, and then resuscitate, which the stations deserve, the audience deserves. But you can't have it both ways. I also am fully empathetic with the management who simply says, we have too few listeners to the station. Our bills are not capable of being met with the pledges that currently come in. That's a crisis. What you do, however, and unfortunately, you say, if whatever money comes in, what is most likely to cause a problem? Well, turning off the electricity, not paying salaries, not having people show up for work. And guess who gets left out of that? Frequently, that's the audience. And yet it should be just the opposite. Your audience should be number one priority. But if you don't have the money to pay every bill, some bills won't get paid. I'm very empathetic with the fact that the management finds itself in that position at this time. But we have to be more creative, we have to be more positive, and we have to look at every possible way that through programming and through maybe even making a station completely voluntary and community-based, that there will still be a heartbeat that will serve the local community. So if you turn on the radio soon and you don't hear me here, understand that I've appreciated the responsibility I've had on this air for a long time. But I will continue on Progressive Radio Network and all the other stations around the country and around the world that carry this. You can call this number and listen to my show live any day. Write it down, 717-734-6955. 717-734-6955. Now we go to the latest on health and healing, and that's something everyone benefits from. Well, what they're finding is ashwagandha. Let me spell it for you. A-S-H-W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A, ashwagandha. It's a very powerful herb, has a lot of healing benefits, but one that's not been noticed before but is now, is that it helps people with dementia or other neurodegenerative disorders, including cognitive decline and memory deficits, due mainly to a beta amyloid deposition in the brain, what is called the tau, T-A-U, protein hyperphosphorylation. And so this is important that you use ashwagandha if you have someone who has memory loss, brain damage. By the way, one of the best things you can do is light therapy and hyperbaric therapy. Hyperbaric is good for burns, of course, but stroke, absolutely, and brain damage, absolutely. Look at the scientific literature. Call the physicians who are actually using hyperbaric, and it will make a tremendous difference. And then, of course, there are supplements and different protocols you can use to rebuild much of your brain, and we've done it. And we have people, you've heard them on the air here, who have made major improvements. reverse conditions that their doctors, neurologists told them were irreversible. And yet my scientific studies, of which I've done 49, were all overseen by board-certified neurologists. So take your ashwagandha as just one part of an overall protocol. Also, a lot of green juices will help as well. Another study found that, well, we have to have a good amount of calcium in our body because unlike the rest of the body, there is not enough real estate in the brain for stored energy. Instead, the brain relies on hundreds of miles of blood vessels within it to supply fresh energy via the blood. Yet, how the brain expresses a need for more energy during increased activity and then directs its blood flow specifically to hot spots until now was poorly understood. Now, the good news is the University of Maryland School of Medicine and the University of Vermont have shown how the brain communicates to blood vessels when it needs for energy increase and how these blood vessels respond by relaxing or constricting to direct blood flow to specific brain regions. How cool is that? This was published in the current issue of Science Advances, and the researchers say that understanding how the brain directs energy to itself in intricate detail can help determine what goes wrong in conditions like Alzheimer's and dementia, where faulty blood flow is a predictor of cognitive impairment. If the blood does not get, the brain does not get blood to where it needs the blood, well, then the neurons become stressed, and over time they deteriorate, ultimately leading to cognitive decline and memory problems. Large arteries feed medium-sized vessels known as arterioles that then feed even tinier capillaries, so small that only a single blood cell can pass through at once. In fact, there was an article, I believe it was in 2017, Nature Neuroscience. The researchers showed that electrical pulses coursing through the capillaries direct blood flow from the medium-sized arterioles supply large enough and coursing through the capillaries directly into the blood. Into the brain. In any case, it's just using calcium, I would say about 800 milligrams a day, along with 800 milligrams of magnesium from citrate, would help tremendously in this process. By the way, there are 5,000 calcium signals per second in capillaries in the tiny section of the brain visible through the window, which they say amounts to about 1 million of these responses every second in the entire brain's blood vessel system. So for those of you who thought everything was just purely evolutionary, well, not true, but that's all right. We can allow the skeptics to hold their linear and Descartes view of the world, and the rest of us who believe in energy, have deep faith in higher principles, know that there's a different argument here. I don't have time for that argument. It's an argument I share with atheists and who I respect, and agnostics, and to let them know at a science level, I can explain a lot of things that science cannot show, but still exist. I'll just give you one example. Why is it that you were never taught, not a single lesson in life, how often to blink? Your eyelids come up and down. They're creating a tear duct, which that tear then moisturizes the eye and prevents it from chafing and going blind. Well, who taught it to do that? Who taught your stomach how much hydrochloric acid, how much pepsin and amylase and lipase enzymes that break down your food? And how long did it take to break it down? And why is it that some foods take longer than others? And then what happens if you drink a beverage, cold beverage or hot beverage with a meal? How does that impact the hydrochloric acid levels and the enzyme levels in your stomach? All this happens without you ever being taught. And yet it happens in every single person on earth, or they would die. Well, who taught it to do that? Who taught your heart when you're running to speed up the pulse and blood pressure, blood going through your veins, and the release of glycogen, the stored energy in your cells? Who taught it that? But when you stop, it comes back down to normal. It doesn't go below normal. And when you're sleeping, it goes down again. Your whole metabolism goes slower. by 10%. Who taught it that? And there are 100 other objective lessons to what life is about. Remember, life was never meant to be figured out. It was meant to be lived at a higher level of awareness and consciousness. And from the Mayo Clinic comes a study about dementia. 1 in 20 cases, dementia is now in people who are 65 and younger. And I've seen it in people as young as 50. Why? Simple. It's not complicated. Electromagnetic pulses from cell phones and computers that we have now everywhere, they're ubiquitous today. Smart meters on homes, 5G, and all those cell towers. That's putting pulsed electromagnetic pollution right into your brain and your body, and that speeds up inflammatory responses all over the body. That's one. Alcohol consumption's two. Poor diet, three. Lack of exercise, four. Excessively sedentary, five. Stress, six. Those are just six reasons why we're seeing dementia. When we live a life without ever asking what is the likely outcome if I make the wrong choice, but also begs the question, do I want to know the truth or do I stop at the certainty of my own beliefs? What if your certainty of beliefs are wrong? So those are just some of the things we need to know. So therefore, all the more reason to pay careful attention. And finally, from Washington University School of Medicine, we have what is called the good cholesterol, which is the HDL cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein, and it protects the liver. And the HDL protects the liver by blocking inflammatory signals produced by common gut bacteria. This is published in the peer-reviewed Neuroscience. So when you're eating good bacteria, meaning good probiotics, and you're not eating sugar, then you're telling your cholesterol that you're going to get feedback from the intestinal microbiome, enhancing your immune system and enhancing the protection of your liver. It works that way in an overly simplified fashion. That's the latest on Health and the Healing. We are 22 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to share a special commentary. Richard Gale and myself spent about almost all night, so we'll share this with you in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. This article will be posted on GaryNoll.com along with hundreds of other articles, as well as on PRN.fm. You can watch our upcoming video that we're going to share with you in a few moments, also by going to PRN.fm. Share this information with people. You have no idea what it means to connect with someone who you didn't know what they might do with something, but then they start to share it and suddenly more people become aware. We like to share real scholarship. The fact that we take the time to look at the science, look for the truth without any political, ideological agenda. Whatever the truth is, that's what we're sharing. This is called Learning to Loathe GMOs, a critical response to the New York Times. In its July 19th issue, the New York Times Magazine published a brilliant piece of twisted pseudoscientific propaganda, in our opinion. The essay entitled Learning to Love GMOs is truly stunning. Its author, journalist Jessica Kahn, takes readers who would have little to no understanding of genetic engineering and genetically modified organisms, GMOs, through a fictional labyrinth, in our opinion, of outdated and conflated GMO similitudes to an endpoint where readers might believe GMOs are really cool and there's nothing to be frantically worried about. Kahn spins the story of Kathy Martin's research to develop a genetically engineered purple tomato high in the antioxidant anthocyanin as the work of a solo humanitarian to improve consumers' health by providing nutrient-rich GMO produce. So far, so good. I'm on board. If you can show me where people are creating a product that has been thoroughly tested that will not change or become a part of our own DNA, but rather provide us with greater nutrient availability, I'm for it. However, what is missing from Kahn's equation is that the research was conducted at one of the world's oldest and most prestigious independent centers for plant science, the John Innes Center in the United Kingdom. The center, which is registered as a charity, lists over 500 employees and is funded by some of the largest proponents of genetically modified plants. I would want to know, who funds this? Well, how about Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? And how about the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council? Oh, well, that's interesting. That gives me a different perspective. This center's website includes purple tomatoes as one of its projects that combines, quote, transcription factors, biosynthetic genes, and iRNA, inference RNA, with the availability of natural tomato mutants. Okay, end quote. What exactly is a natural tomato mutant? And why would I want that in my body? The iRNA, or post-transcription gene slicing, is a method to silence certain genes the researchers desire to curtail their expression. The Times article makes an effort to advance the flawed agrochemical mantra of sustainable and substantial equivalence without citing the term. The earlier acceptance of GMOs was largely based upon the unproven hypothesis of substantial equivalence. In just lay language, it means this. Let's say that I'm growing a tomato as a certified organic farmer, and they're growing a tomato made of genetically modified ingredients in their seeds, and they're saying, oh, they're both the same. They're identical. Not a problem. Ah, is that true? The USDA's adoption of this concept during Bill Clinton's first term in the White House gave GMO seed companies a free pass to avoid submitting trial evidence to prove the environmental and health safety of genetically modified crops. Since the ruling claims that GMOs are fundamentally identical genetically to their natural counterparts, no compliance of safety regulations should necessarily apply. Therefore, big agri firms did not have to worry over strict regulatory hurdles, which otherwise apply to other products such as pharmaceutical drugs, processed foods, pesticides, cosmetics, and chemical additives. However, during the past decade, a flurry of research has shown that the, quote, substantial equivalence, meaning they're equal, of genetically modified foods versus regular foods, hypothesis is patently false. Alexandria University in Egypt, the Permaculture Research Institute, and the Norwegian Center for Biosafety each found genetically modified crops to be fundamentally different. So, was that promoted in the New York Times and all the other major media? No. In addition, the studies have confirmed that nutrient levels in traditional organically raised crops are substantially higher than genetically modified varieties. New technological methods to create concise profiles of a food's molecular composition, notably omics, O-M-I-C-S, were not available in the early 1900s when Clinton wore the mantle of America's first biotech president. Omic technology destroyed the big agri industry's arguments to support the lie about sustainable equivalence or substantial equivalence. For example, King's College London published a study in the highly respected peer-reviewed Scientific Reports of Nature, revealing unquestionable genetic consequences between GMO Roundup and non-GMO corn. The differences included changes in 117 proteins and 91 metabolites. Big difference. Despite substantial equivalence having been debunked, the erroneous hypothesis continues to linger in pro-GMO propaganda. However, in Kahn's recent essay, she attempts to shift attention away from the early generation of GMOs, which were engineered solely to sell more toxic pesticides, and emphasize GMOs' potential for increasing nutrition health and to advance medicine. Well, that's certainly a noble cause. In order to add a bit of balance, Kahn quotes James Madison University professor Alan Leibovitz, who accurately described one fundamental criticism, among many others, against GMOs. Quote, with genetic engineering, there's a feeling that we're mucking about with the essential building blocks of reality. We may feel okay about rearranging genes the way nature does, but we're not comfortable mixing them up between creatures, end quote. But most disturbing to us is Kahn's failure to make any mention of the trial of environmental disasters and disease risks due to consuming genetically modified foods. She completely whitewashes the matter. She prefers we may forget that Monsanto soy and corn, which now represent the majority of these crops grown in the United States, was developed solely to allow farmers to spray highly toxic pesticides without injuring the food. These crops contain notable concentrations of the pesticide that then find their way into the numerous consumer food products, including baby foods. Nor should we forget that Roundup-grown foods may be destroying people's microbiome. Last year, researchers at the University of Turku in Finland reported, quote, conservative estimate that approximately 54% of organisms in our microbiome are potentially sensitive to glyphosate. Despite her pro-GMO advocacy, if Kahn's conscience had led her to take a moral high road, in our belief, she would have at least apologized on Monsanto's behalf for the trail of death and disease the company and its glyphosate has left in its wake. The company has yet to atone despite losing three trials with $2.4 billion fines, repeated appeal losses, and being ordered to pay $10.5 billion in settlements. To date, Monsanto's glyphosate poisoning has been identified with the suppression of essential gut enzymes and amino acid synthesis, gluten intolerance, disruption of manganese pathways, neurological disease, cancer, amyloidosis, autoimmune disease. Her New York Times article would have better served the improvement of public health as a warning rather than applause to appease companies such as Bayer, Monsanto, and Syngenta. And shame on the New York Times editors for permitting such biased, in our opinion, misinformation to find its way into print. Kahn is eager to cite findings showing GMO's benefits without indicating her sources. Possibly she has them. Good for her if she does. Where are they? She tells us that environmental groups have, quote, quietly walked back their opposition as evidence has mounted that GMOs are both safe to eat and not inherently bad for the environment, end quote. Kahn doesn't mention who these groups might be. She reframes the Philippine story of the destruction of genetically engineered golden rice, yet around that time, even the pro-industry magazine Forbes published an article questioning golden rice's viability and noting that its benefits are only based upon unfounded hypothesis. As for its risk to health, GMO Watch in the United Kingdom points out the work conducted by David Schubert at the Salk Institute that the rice might potentially generate vitamin A derivatives that could, quote, damage human fetuses and cause birth defects. Should this not be of concern? Kahn, who should be acknowledged as a highly respected scientist, science journalist, and teaches journalism at the University of California, Berkeley's campus, happens also, we found, to be a contributing editor and author of the Genetic Literacy Project. What's that? Well, it's the University of California, Davis, a public relations operation sponsored by the agrochemical industry. Monsanto, Bayer, Syngenta, and DuPont are among the industry partners in that group. It is one of the most frequently quoted sources of cherry-picked information by pro-GMO advocates and journalists. In our opinion, it is perhaps one of the most financially compromised and scientifically illiterate organizations, founded and funded to disseminate pro-GMO propaganda in order to prop up public support for GMOs and genetic engineering in general. In effect, some universities now act as well, unfortunately, as private industry's lobbyist. This becomes a greater scandal when the university is a public institution receiving public funding. GLP, the group, and its East Coast partner, Cornell University's Alliance for Science, largely funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, serve as the GMO industry's clearinghouses for public relations to spin science into advertising, propaganda, and character assassination of GMO's opponents. The Genetic Literacy Project is a key collaborator with another food industry front group, the American Council on Science and Health. The group has nothing, in our opinion, to do with actual health science. It has been described by the independent corporate financial watchdog organization SourceWatch as a thinly veiled corporate front that holds, quote, a generally apologetic stance regarding virtually every other health and environmental hazard produced by modern industry, accepting corporate funding from Coca-Cola, Syngenta, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg, General Mills, PepsiCo, and the American Beverage Association, and among others, end quote. The American Council on Science and Health also favors toxic pesticides, the use of biphenyl A in products, cigarettes, and hydrofracking. It is closely aligned with pseudo-medical front organizations that criticize alternative and natural health modalities, such as Quackwatch and the Science-Based Medicine Network. This group, the GLP group, sources a couple thousand corporate-friendly studies favoring GMO safety. One review of over 1,700 studies, known as the Nicolia Review, for a time was the most cited source making the broadest claims for GMO safety. Go GMO. However, subsequent independent and unbiased reviews of Nicolia's analysis concluded that many of these studies were tangential at best and barely took notice of anything related to crop genetic engineering or GMOs. Many studies are completely irrelevant from a value-added perspective because they have nothing to do with GMO safety. Furthermore, other studies in Nicolai's collection conclude the exact opposite of their intention and give further credibility to GMO's environmental and animal and human health risks. When Nicolia published this review, he intentionally omitted and ignored scientifically sound research that directly investigated GMO safety and found convincing evidence to issue warnings. For example, one peer-reviewed publication by over 300 independent scientists declared that there is no scientific consensus that GMO crops and food are safe. Not surprisingly, there is no mention of this study in the Nicolia review. It's no secret that Monsanto and Big Ag have significant influence over the University of California Davis's agricultural department and divisions. The, in our opinion, bogus economic studies trumped up by the Big Ag cartel to defeat California's GMO labeling bill, Proposition 37, was performed at University of California Davis and then publicized through the GLP. Gary Reshkin, who has been filing Freedom of Information Act requests, has publicly expressed deep concerns that University of California Davis is acting as a financial conduit for private corporations and interests to develop and launch PR attacks against academics, professors, activists, and other institutions who oppose those same corporate interests. For GMO opponents, the name Mark Lyonis may send shivers down the spine. As soon as any journalist or researcher mentions Lyonis' name approvingly, one can be certain which camp the author represents. You can be assured that you'll be reading words on, well, about the pro-GMO and attacking those who have a different point of view. Therefore, when Kahn quotes Lyonis as if he were an unbiased authority about GMOs, she may have done so innocently enough. Give her the benefit of a doubt. Maybe she didn't read all the things that we have. So we know, however, that you're boarding the wrong train and will reach a destination of distorted scientific facts and self-righteous corporate praise, in our opinion. Remember, if your sources are not good and reliable, objective and honest, and not biased, then what is the point of the whole process? Find those people who have the truth. But what if those people are not in your camp? The public watchdog group U.S. Right to Know describes Lioness as, quote, a former journalist turned promotional advocate for genetically engineered foods and pesticides who makes inaccurate claims about those products from his perch at the Gates Foundation, or Gates-funded Cornell Alliance for Science, end quote. Lioness has accused those who would inform the public about Roundup carcinogenic properties as conducting, quote, a witch hunt, and by anti-Monsanto activists who abuse science. Really? Okay. Why don't you tell that to the people who've won cases, landmark cases, against Monsanto to show their cancers came from being around glyphosate? And it's not just three initially. There are tens of thousands now. Lioness has denied his role as a shill for Big Agra. Okay. However, a decade ago, The Guardian acquired a private memo from the pro-biotechnology organization at Eurobi about its initiative to recruit, quote, ambassadors, end quote, to preach the GMO gospel. Mark Lioness was specifically named in the document alongside then-UN Secretary General Kofi Annan as a prime candidate to pressure European agencies who are skeptical about GMO claims, promises, and health and environmental risks. In short, Lioness has been one of Big Agra's most invaluable foot soldiers for over a dozen years. Similar to the Genetic Literacy Project, the Cornell Alliance for Science does not conduct any agricultural research, yet its tentacles to attack GMO opponents are far-reaching in the media. The Genetic Literacy Project and the Cornell Alliance of Science was launched in 2014 after the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation granted the Alliance $5.6 million to start up the program. The Public Relations Alliance makes the unfounded claim to represent, quote, balanced, end quote, research about genetic engineered products. One of its missions is to influence the next generation of agricultural scientists to embrace GMO science. For CAS, as for Bill Gates, GMOs are the only food solution for Africa's future. 5 years ago, organic New York farmers mobilized to pressure the trustees of Cornell University to evict CAS from the campus and halt its influence over the school's prestigious College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. One argument Con wants us to buy into is that there are mistakes made during the early rollout of GMOs in the early 1990s, but somehow mysteriously and without any solid evidence, we are supposed to believe that these same companies now engineering new generations of crops have learned their lessons. All that has really changed has been the genetic technology for altering plant genomes. The same mindset that only technology and the quest for food dominance remain. After hundreds of thousands of dollars were flushed away during the genetically modified wheat project, a retired professor of plant agriculture at the University of Guelph in Canada remarked, quote, we scientists and the public are so malleable and gullible, or is it because researchers and research administrators are just desperate for money that we swallow and become promoters of the mantra that GM is somehow going to feed the world by resolving the monumental threat of the burnt toast or browning in cut apples or flower color in carnations. Really? For shame. Let's be honest. The one and only reason these people, corporations, governments are funding this sorry use of lab bench space is because many yield a proprietary product. End quote. Following Linus's lead, Kahn wants us to believe that genes exchanged between different plants is common in nature, and therefore manipulating genes between species with genetic engineering tools such as CRISPR should not worry us. Yes, plants have acquired genes from other organisms in the past, the far distant past, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. However, it is so exceedingly rare that these should be regarded as anomalies without any correlation whatsoever to the millions of different genes available to bioengineer new plant organisms. This has been one of Linus's pet arguments on his bully pulpit since turning over the information he has to the public. It may also be noted that Jennifer Kahn is an active participant in CRISPR.com, a forum dedicated to, quote, the future of CRISPR and gene editing technology applications in agriculture, health, conservation, and more. Among the organization's supporters are Bayer, the Innovative Genomics Institute, Cornell Alliance for Science, Corvetta AgriScience, and the United Soybean Board. A mission noted on its website is expressed in one of its mottos, quote, the public doesn't trust GMOs. We will trust CRISPR. This is a public relations pitch that permeates her Times article. It's in conclusion, it's important for independent investigators and researchers to identify and publicize the background of cloaked public relations individuals posing as unbiased journalists in mainstream news sources. Kahn's New York Times piece is an example, in our opinion, of propaganda and without credibility. It is an attempt to disingenuously manipulate the narrative so more Americans will love GMOs. In the wake of the agricultural industry's efforts to bolster favorable images of GMOs and more recently CRISPR editing technologies, the mainstream media willingly rolls out a red carpet. No equal publishing space is awarded to the scientific critics of genetic engineering who uncover the flaws in the industry's public research. Consequently, journalists such as Mark Linus and Jennifer Kahn are the norm rather than the exception. Today, the lesson is clear that, well, it's who influences us, coming from the private industry or the universities, that can then become public statements. Ah, so easy to trust someone automatically if they're a professor at a prestigious university. Maybe they should be trusted. But shouldn't we first do our homework? 7 years ago, 70% of Americans, according to a Consumer Reports National Research Center survey, did not want genetically modified organisms in their food. In 2018, the Pew Research Center reported that only 5% of Americans said GMO food was better for one's health, which about makes up the number of people who are in one way or another invested in the agricultural industry. Still over half believe that they endanger health. Yet too much has been invested into agrotechnology to expect GMOs to disappear anytime soon. As the public increasingly turns away from genetically modified organisms in their produce and goes to organic produce, which is booming, we will expect new volleys of industry propaganda like that penned, in our opinion, by Jennifer Kahn to dangle new carrots. For Kahn, one of those rotten carrots is to improve nutritional content. Yet, similar to the golden rice, this will need to be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. We can also expect to hear ever wider information coming at us, making irrational claims about how GMO-based agriculture might reduce CO2 greenhouse pollution and save humanity. And we must expect that this PR campaign will be backed by the World Economic Forum, full throttle, the Great Reset invasion. In other words, out of the desperation to reach global food dominance, the agricultural chemical industry, backed by Western governments, will be declaring a full food war against the peoples of the world. It's time for us to unlearn any illusion attached to what we have been supporting about big agriculture and learn to loathe GMOs. Just a few additional points. Even today, we are looking at something that is directly impacting our globe and weather. The Amazon, for the first time, is now emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, creating global warming, than it was capturing into its root systems. Why? Right up there, clearing huge tracts of land to plant genetically modified soybeans, then exported to different countries, mainly China, around the world, to feed meat or poultry or pork to its ever-increasing population. When you go to Borneo, you can see hundreds of miles of what was once a thriving rainforest, home to some of the rare orangutans on the planet, now all decimated with palm plantations in their place. What happens with that? Increase in CO2, increase in pollution, and destruction of habitat, and destruction of orangutans. So it is my contention the GMOs have had an opportunity to prove their value and have failed. It is estimated by Dr. Vandana Shiva that over 200,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide because they were using genetically modified cotton and it didn't work. Therefore, they went broke and they killed themselves with the false belief that somehow their debt would be eliminated upon their death. No, their debt followed on to their surviving family members. I produced a film 10 years ago. The film was called Seeds of Death. And it was played over 85 times on Colorado television, on PBS out there, Channel 12. And it was played late at night. Now, that station is funded in part by the Koch brothers. There was a massive campaign and pressure put upon Sherry Bernson, one of the most courageous, brilliant programmers in all of non-commercial television. Get that film off the air. And she kept saying to the critics, including members of her own board, the average person wants to see this. People didn't know this. People didn't know about Seralini feeding rats genetically modified corn and then them developing all these mammary cancers and deformities that happened after 3 months. Up to 3 months, there was nothing. After 3 months, it was all done. They were dead. And Seralini had an article published in the peer-reviewed journal. Then they attacked him. The GMO industry attacked him. People wanted to see this. They wanted to see the truth. That is still true today. But today, you would not, in my opinion, see a single PBS station or an NPR station daring to air the truth about GMOs. Look at where they get their funding. Follow the money. Now you'll know why there's a limitation on truth. That's unfortunate, but it's what it is. We're going to say goodbye to our WBI audience right now, and we're going to continue to top the hour because I want to hear what you have to say on this issue. Give us a call. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. As soon as your calls come through, I'll be happy to take them, and I'll give you some additional information in the interim, and as soon as they come in, we'll take you over there. For example, this is just in today. Jennifer Mosley told the Des Moines Register that she noticed a swollen lymph node in her left arm 2 days after receiving her second dose of the Pfizer vaccine in April. But because the swollen lymph node was in the same arm where she had the vaccine, she didn't think much about it. 2 days later, the lymph node was still tender. Mosley, who had a family history of breast cancer, realized she hadn't done a breast self-exam in a while. When she did the self-exam, she found a lump the size of a flattened grape in her right breast. Mosley made an appointment with her doctor to get the lump checked out, which led to a mammogram and a biopsy. Finally, in mid-May, she received a diagnosis. She had stage 2 invasive lobular carcinoma breast cancer, the same cancer that killed her cousin at age 38. Swollen lymph nodes can be a side effect of the COVID-19 vaccine and other types of vaccines, infectious expert Dr. Amish Adjal, MD, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in Maryland, tells the public. Lymph nodes are part, of course, of the immune system, and they can be activated and swell when you're exposed to something like a vaccine. Quote, him's talking, anything that stimulates your immune system can impact the lymph nodes that are near the injection or infection site, end quote. The doctor says this vaccine side effect is so common that the Society for Breast Imaging, SBI, issued a warning about it in February, recommending that women wait to schedule a mammogram at least 4 weeks after their COVID vaccine so women wouldn't think that swollen lymph nodes from the vaccine were a sign of breast cancer. Mosley's vaccine didn't cause the lump in her breast. It started a train of thought that motivated her to check herself for signs of cancer. And so just one more of the things that people should be aware of. And this was from the Des Moines Register. So that's just the latest on that. Something that we're not told that could impact us. Also, this is from Marco Cesarius, and this is just out today. Coronavirus spreading among the vaccinated and highly vaccinated countries. Quote, the Zoe COVID study led by epidemiologist Tim Spector, MD, of King's College in London, estimated that there were 17,581 new daily symptomatic cases of COVID-19 in unvaccinated people, or 22% less than the previous week's total. According to a press release issued by the study's authors, quote, with cases in the vaccinated group continuing to rise, the number of new cases in the vaccinated population is set to overtake the unvaccinated in the coming days, end quote. And also, this was supported by the UK's health secretary, Dr. Javid Jovin. So what do we learn? We learned that everyone's saying the vaccinated are protected. No, they're now getting, in the United Kingdom at least, possibly elsewhere, they're coming down with COVID even after the two vaccines, and it's worse for them than the unvaccinated or the natural vaccines, naturally vaccinated from having the vaccine themselves. Let's say hello to Noel from New York. Hi, Noel. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. It's a pleasure and honor to speak to you, and I truly mean that. My question is, how can the VA, the Veterans Administration, as you probably heard, how can they mandate their people to get the vaccine and it still has not been approved?
It's purely political. None of what they're doing now is based upon science. None of it. And we have to understand that. For example, today, more than half of hospitalized patients tested COVID-19 positive only after being admitted to the hospital. That's according to the National Health Services. So what you have is you have political decisions motivated by factors we are not fully aware of. We can guesstimate that finance is behind it because the Bill and Melinda Gates, Gavi, World Health Organization, and all the pharmaceutical companies, all the biomed companies, you have thousands of individuals, scientists, doctors associated with them who are going without any question. And there is your first red flag. When no one in the orthodox model of is questioning the safety and efficacy of a vaccine, is questioning the accuracy of the PCR, is questioning the ability to put infected and non-infected people in the same home environment without consequence, is not looking at the fact that a virus could be 1,000 times smaller than the hole in a mask, meaning the mask has to have oxygen coming in, so you breathe it in. Then you expel carbon dioxide, much of which stays in the mask and can cause all forms of skin problems, and also can shorten the amount of oxygen coming in the excessive carbon dioxide buildup. But you would think that someone would question, well, how can you say that the mask is what's preventing COVID? It can prevent other larger droplets, but not the virus. There's no science behind it. But then you start seeing there's no science behind any of this. It's pure ideological and political weaponization to their means. Is it power? Is it control? Is it money? A combination of all? That is for each person to decide for themselves. But what you do have now, and what's important on this one, is that for the first time in American history, you have mainstream pro-vaccine, pro-orthodox physicians and scientists challenging the bureaucratic, technocratic, and profit-driven Orthodox doctors and scientists. We've never seen that fight before. So there's no sense to it, and it is constitutionally mandated that no one can, based upon the Nuremberg Code, even though we're not, we say we're not applying that, but nobody in the Geneva Convention, nobody can force you to take an experimental product into your body without your... I would quit the armed forces if that was the case. My life is more important. And I would go to another state where you have that opportunity to have more freedom of choice. At this moment, until the litigation gets going, and it is going, we won't know better. Okay? Thank you for your call. Tonight, 7 o'clock, Celia Farber, one of America's best investigative journalists, has a lot to say about COVID and AIDS. We're going to hear her at 7 p.m. on PRN.FM. Have a nice day, everyone.